Hello, folks. Welcome to the LRIS podcast series. This is Will Aitchison, and I'm here today with a special podcast. Last night, the Minnesota legislature passed one of the largest police reform bills in the nation. It's right up there with what was done in Colorado. We are posting online at LRIS.com a link to the legislation and as well a link to a summary of the legislation that I have provided. What I want to do now is briefly, it's not going to be that long a podcast, briefly go through what the essential elements of this bill are. As you will see, it's a potpourri of different provisions relating to training and deadly force standards. Probably the biggest change that you're going to see is it's going to become virtually impossible for a Minnesota police union to win a disciplinary arbitration in the future. So with that, let's dive in. There are almost 30 sections to this bill. I'm going to go through them in a sequential way. The big stuff, binding arbitration, we don't get to for a little while. So section one of the bill provides for peer counseling. That actually was a provision in the statute that had existed before. But what section one of the bill does in conjunction with section three of the bill is it reduces the confidentiality that is given to peer support counseling. Under the previous version of the law, peer support county was what Minnesota calls private data that was not subject to disclosure. Under the combination of sections 1 and 3 of this law, it still is private data, but there are 5 exceptions under which the person who does peer counseling is allowed to disclose the information provided in the peer support process. What are those 5 exceptions? One is if the counselor reasonably believes that the disclosure is necessary to prevent the person receiving the counseling, and this, by the way, could be firefighters or police or corrections officers, prevent that person from doing harm to themselves or others. Second exception is the information can be disclosed if the peer counseling discloses information that is subject to the state's mandatory reporting requirements, for example, child abuse and the like. Third exception is if the person who receives the peer counseling consents in writing to the disclosure of the information. Fourth, if the person who got the counseling is deceased, the surviving spouse can consent to the disclosure of the information. The fifth is the one that is, I think, very, very troubling of all of these. I'm going to read it to you verbatim, that the information can be disclosed if, and I'm quoting, the emergency service provider who received public safety peer counseling voluntarily testifies, in which the peer support counselor may be compelled to testify on the same subject. So what in the world does that mean? I'm not sure. Well, you don't know from the way it is written. There are two possibilities there, though, right? One is, let's assume this is a police officer. Let's assume it's a deadly force incident. And let's assume that officer testifies before a grand jury or in trial, civil or criminal trial, on what happened out on the street where deadly force was used. Does that mean that the peer support counselor can be compelled to testify about what the officer told her or him? In other words, is the peer support counseling the, and I'm quoting from the statute, same subject as what actually went on the street? Or is it only if the emergency service provider testifies about the peer support counseling that the counselor can testify? I think it's completely unclear. To my reading, it's the first of those two choices, that if the employee actually testifies as to what went on in the incident, then the peer support counselor is released. That's not what the legislators intended in Minnesota. They need to edit this bill. I just went over sections 1 and 3. Section 2, in the middle of them, creates a new definition for something called critical incident stress management data. And that is picked up in section 4 of the bill, which create critical incident stress management team members as a concept. And they get the same conditional privilege that peer support counselors get, subject to those same exceptions, including that very troublesome fifth exception. But one thing that's kind of interesting is the privilege only applies to people who meet the statute's definition of a critical incident stress management team member. Who are those people? Quoting from the statute, they are people who are, quote, trained to provide critical incident stress management services in accordance with standards that are both established by a nationally recognized critical incident stress management organization or network, and 2, recognized by the Commissioner of Public Safety. Really? Now, I try to pay attention to these things, and forgive me if I am wrong, but I don't think there is a nationally recognized critical incident stress management organization or network that has established standards. Again, I may be wrong on that, but if I'm right, that means nobody in Minnesota can be a critical incident stress management team member unless and until those standards are developed and the Commissioner of Public Safety in Minnesota agrees with those standards. And then the individual critical incident stress management team members have to be approved by the same agency. Once again, a lot of work needed on that. Filling in the gaps of what's going on. Section 5 is a big change, and that is that all deadly force investigations will be now conducted by the Statewide Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The legislation calls for the creation of a new use of force investigations unit within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and they have the ability to, they have the sole ability from this point forward to do deadly force investigations. Section 6, kind of coming right out of the blue and apropos of nothing we've talked about so far, deals with residency. And it allows home rule cities and counties to offer peace officer residency exceptions. Interesting. Don't know what that is all about. Section 7 and 8 deal with use of force, and the key here is that there will be new prohibitions on certain types of restraints. What types of restraints will be prohibited? Number 1, chokeholds, and I'll give you the definition of that in a moment. 2, tying all of a person's limbs together behind their back. And 3, securing a person in a way that results in transporting the person face down, and so that their air face down in a vehicle, so that their ability to breathe is impacted, or so that they could potentially be hurt. Now, yeah, a chokehold is defined, and I'm quoting, as a method by which a person applies sufficient pressure to another person to make breathing difficult or impossible, and includes, but is not limited to, any pressure on the neck, throat, or windpipe that may prevent or hinder breathing or reduce intake of air. And it also includes carotid artery holds. Section 10, there's a post board in Minnesota, Peace Officer Standards and Training. And the board will be expanded from 15 to 17 members in Section 10, with additional members to be members of the public appointed by the governor. Section 11 deals with post licenses, and it It basically allows the post board to create a subcommittee to investigate whether or not police officer licenses should be pulled and or granted. And that subcommittee has to have, under this legislation, one public member and two members who are current or former peace officers. Section 12, get ready on this. It's called warrior style training. And this section defines warrior style training. And I've got to quote this because I can't paraphrase it because, in truth, I just simply don't understand it. Warrior style training is, quote, training for peace officers that dehumanizes people or encourages aggressive conduct by peace officers during encounters with others in a manner that de-emphasizes the value of human life or constitutional rights, the result of which increases a peace officer's likelihood or willingness to use deadly force. And that is language that could almost hardly be more poorly drawn. That language could apply to standard self-defense tactics. It could apply to what I think they're really objecting to, which is caliber press style training. But it is language that needs much, much, much work. Warrior style training will be prohibited for post credits or tuition reimbursement, and all local law enforcement agencies are prohibited from providing warrior style training, and I'm quoting, directly or through a third party, end quote, to a peace officer. Okay, section 13. There's going to be a new council created. It's going to be called the Ensuring Police Excellence and Improving Community Relations Advisory Council. It will be made up of 15 members, 10 of whom are members of the public. What's this council going to do? It's going to assist the post board in, and I'm quoting, maintaining policies and regulating peace officers in a manner that ensures the protection of civil and human rights. The council, that's the end of the quote, the council must provide for citizen involvement in policing policies, regulations, and supervision. And the council has to advance policies and reforms that promote positive interactions between peace officers and the community. And whatever it is this council comes up with by way of recommendations, those recommendations have to be placed on the agenda for the post board for consideration for adoption. Section 14, a modest change. It calls for POST to become the central repository for all peace officer data that is designated as public data under the public records law in Minnesota. 15th, there's going to be a single use of force standard in Minnesota for all agencies. What's it going to be? We don't know yet, but we do know that POST has about a month and a week to come up with it. So I'm quoting from the legislation. By September 1, 2020, POST must adopt an updated comprehensive written model policy on the use of force, including deadly force, and distribute this policy to the chief law enforcement officer of every agency in the state. What does the model policy have to say? First of all, it must, and I'm quoting, recognize and respect the sanctity and value of all human life and the need to treat everyone with dignity and without prejudice. And it's got to include three things. The policy has to include a duty for peace officers to intercede when present and observing another police officer using force beyond that which is objectively reasonable under the law and the particular circumstances of the case, where the officer is in a position to intercede. I'll come back to that. Number two, the policy has to say that there is a duty for peace officers to report an illegal use of force by another peace officer, report it to whoever their boss is. And third, the policy must require that less lethal methods be considered first by the officer. That does not say must be considered first by the officer where it is possible to do so. It simply says must be considered first by the officer. So that, of course, is very problematic because there are some situations where officers react on the basis of information that is being processed within a second or less or slightly more. How can the officer consider less lethal measures when someone has just pulled a gun on them and the officer hasn't even unholstered his or her handgun? So that's very problematic. Now let's go back to the duty to intercede. Let's talk about that. The way this is phrased is there's a duty to intercede when present and observing another peace officer using force beyond that which is objectively reasonable. Objectively reasonable from whose perspective? The officer using the force or the officer seeing the other officer use the force? Because, of course, those two officers may be seeing something completely different. And without that indication in this statute, you've got a world of problems that are going to be created with the interpretation and application of policies created under this model policy. Now, the last part of Section 15 requires that all agencies adopt policies that are, quote, identical or substantially similar to the model policy. So there's going to be one use of force policy in the state of Minnesota. Section 16 just requires record keeping of everything that was developed under the model policy. Section 17 grants posts the authority to seek injunctions to ensure compliance with its rules, particularly the statewide force standards. Section 18 requires agencies to submit all sorts of data to post on an individual officer by officer basis that will allow post as it deems necessary to evaluate the effectiveness of training to assist that ensuring police excellence in improving community relations advisory council in accomplishing its duties and allowing the board to, and I'm quoting, identify patterns of behavior that suggests that an officer is in crisis or is likely to violate a board mandated model policy. That's pretty stunning stuff. And when you think about it, that third requirement could involve all sorts of physical and psychological information. I don't see any provisions in the statute that call for confidentiality on the part of post in the way that information is handled or that would forbid post from disclosing that information to the public. Once again, I think this statute needs an awful lot of work. Section 19 mandates training for every officer in the state in crisis intervention, mental health crises, conflict management, mediation, ensuring safer interactions between peace officers and persons with autism, recognizing and valuing community diversity and cultural differences, and it must include implicit bias training. I've got to say, every time I see implicit bias training, as part of these bills that are being circulated right now, it just kind of screws me into the ceiling. And the reason is that people on all sides of the agenda here recognize there is absolutely no good evidence that implicit bias training accomplishes anything. And yet, when we see these bills that mandate implicit bias training, same thing happened in Colorado, what we're doing is we're creating a multi-million dollar business. It's already a multi-million dollar business. We're increasing the value of those businesses to provide training, the worth of which has never been established, even though people have really tried to establish that it does something. So at any rate, back to Section 19. All this training, crisis intervention, all of that training is going to have to be provided by a post-approved entity. How much training? At least 16 credits of training. Every 3 years, officers are licensed on a three-year basis. 16 of those credits, 16 credits must be for crisis intervention and mental health crisis training, and 4 hours must focus on safer interactions with peace officers and persons with autism. It's a lot of reference to autism in this Minnesota bill, and you can see the power of whatever lobbying group it was that focused on interactions with police and people with autism. What does the training have to include? 9 things. It must include at least these 9 things. Techniques for relating to individuals with mental illnesses and their families, techniques for crisis de-escalation, techniques for relating to diverse communities and education on mental illness diversity, training on mental illnesses and the criminal justice system, training on community resources and support for individuals experiencing a mental health crisis and their families, training on psychotropic medications and their side effects, training on co-occurring mental illnesses and substance use disorders, training on suicide prevention, and training on mental illnesses and disorders and their symptoms. When I read all that, I was struck by the fact that part of the police reform movement in a lot of places is, let's get police out of the business of responding to mental health calls. The more nuanced view, let's get police out of the business of responding to many or some mental health calls. Minnesota seems to be going the other way with this, don't they? They seem to want to be making police officers mental health experts. So it's just interesting what the different approaches are. I'm guessing they're not exclusionary, that you would end up in Minnesota with a whole bunch of well-trained police officers on mental health issues who might be responding to fewer mental health calls because you'd have some non-police responding to them. It's not mutually exclusive. Section 20 is very specific on autism training, and it requires mandatory autism training both before a peace officer goes into service as a recruit and also on an in-service basis. And there's all sorts of requirements specified with respect to what has to be in the autism training. Section 22 lines out what the duty to intercede is and specifies that the duty to intercede is regardless of tenure or rank. That's getting at that officer in Minneapolis who'd been on the job 1 day or 2 days or whatever it had been. Peace officers will be required to intercede when, number one, they are present and observing another peace officer in using force in violation of the law, or otherwise beyond that which is objectively reasonable under the circumstances, and two, physically and verbally able to intercede. Once again, we've got that huge problem with objectively reasonable that they are clearly going to have to fix. Section 22, arbitration. Here it comes. It's one of, I've got to say, someone who's spent decades in labor relations, this is one of the sorriest pieces of legislation I think I've seen. It entirely changes the system of disciplinary arbitrations. Arbitrators are no longer going to be selected by the parties. They are going to be selected from a list of six arbitrators picked by and maintained by the state of Minnesota. So there will only be six arbitrators hearing all disciplinary appeals of police officers in Minnesota. How will they be selected from this list of six? They will be selected on an alphabetically rotating basis. So who are these six people and what is required of them? Well, how's the state going to pick them? The state is going to be allowed to consider. The phrase is may consider the usual standards for selecting arbitrators, you know, experience, expertise, labor relations background, that sort of stuff. And now I'm quoting, as well as a candidate's experience and training in cultural competency, racism, implicit bias, and recognizing and valuing community diversity and cultural differences. All right, so they get selected. Is there any strike method where you take people off the list who are incompetent? No, that's up to the state. The state can put people on the list of six and take them off the list if they are not performing, they are subject to performance standards, not performing the way the state wants them to perform. The six arbitrators are prohibited from serving, and I'm quoting, as an arbitrator in a labor arbitration other than a grievance arbitration as defined by the law. So in other words, these six arbitrators who are going to hear police cases, who may or may not have labor relations backgrounds, cannot be arbitrators in the private or public sector in any other type of case. How are they going to be trained? They're supposed to receive training that will include at least 6 hours of training on cultural competency, racism, implicit bias, and recognizing and valuing community diversity and cultural differences. They also have to get 6 hours of training on topics related to the daily experience of police officers, which may include ride-alongs. So who in their right mind is going to want to be an arbitrator in Minnesota, who's going to be one of these six arbitrators on this police list? First of all, is it going to be an experienced, good arbitrator? Of course not. They have to give up the rest of their arbitration practice to be on this list of six arbitrators. You can pretty much scratch off the list everybody who has any sort of arbitration competence in Minnesota. So who will end up being on this list? Well, we know they're going to have to satisfy the state, right? Otherwise, they'll be taken off of this list. It's pretty easy to see how cynical this section of the statute is. You're going to have a group of six people who are beholden to the state essentially for their, not essentially for their entire income as an arbitrator who can be taken off if the state in its unreviewable discretion decides they are reaching the wrong results. It's just simply a travesty, this portion of the bill. The last sections of the bill, sections 23 through 27, continue, I think, the cynicism. They're all funding bills, and they provide temporary funding. For example, there's temporary funding for the use of force investigations unit in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that's going to do all the deadly force investigations. It's funding of $3.3 million in fiscal year 2021. What's the funding level in fiscal year 2024? Zero. In other words, the department is going to have to shift funds into this independent use of force investigations unit from other law enforcement purposes. And same thing is true for Post, for example. Post was given $1.5 million in 2021 to design the database for all of this public data it's going to get. What's the funding in 2024? Zero. Well, that's it. That was passed by the Minnesota legislature last night. The governor has indicated he is going to sign it. This is a bill that really brings to life, much in the way the Colorado bill did, something I've been warning people about for years now. When you get out to the far left and far rights of the political continuum, you find those people agreeing on some things. And one of the things they agree upon is police officers shouldn't have a meaningful way to appeal discipline. And that's what you see with the arbitration provisions in this bill. So if you're in a state where you've got police reform measures pending in the legislature, or even if you don't, take a look at what we're posting online with respect to the Minnesota bill. The Minnesota bill was one of these gut and stuff bills, where there was a bill that was introduced on an entirely different subject, and then in the last minute, the legislature simply took out all of that other stuff and put in all the police reform measures. That can happen to you no matter where you are, even if you don't have a police reform measure pending in the legislature right now. You can have one pending within 24 hours. It can occur. So with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off. Hang in there, everybody.